Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis. How are you?
I'm grand. I can't wait to talk to our next guest.
Yeah? She's going to be great.
In the next segment, we have Fuchsia Dunlop, who is probably the English-speaking world's top authority on Chinese food, and she wrote a book on Sichuan cuisine, but she's written the Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook, recipes from Hunan Province about real Hunan cuisine.
I think it's going to surprise people.
Yeah,
I think the whole show is going to surprise people.
We're going to speak to her from her home in London.
You know, and that will be fun, I promise, but is there anything more fun right now than watching YouTube?
No, I have to say, I would get 2 hours more sleep a night if it weren't for YouTube.
I'll tell you the things that you can find on YouTube. So one of our listeners, a guy by the name of Kelvin in Chicago, sent me this great website of
video
of a restaurant in Japan which has a deep fryer over its goldfish tank.
Explain exactly how that works. The oil sits on top of the water,
deep
right?
Deep fryer oil. Some company has made them a deep fryer, and the oil floats on the water. And it's their fryer, and it sits on top of their goldfish tank. So the dregs of the fryer, like the little morsels that fall to the bottom of your fryer normally,
fall into the
fish tank, and the little fishies eat it.
That's creepy.
I got to tell you, very creepy looking.
I mean, if a fish swims up, don't they get fried goldfish on the side?
I don't know. Obviously, they can't get all the way to the top. You know, they can't get into the oil, or they might. But it's a little creepy looking, and honestly, it's a little murky looking, too, the water that the goldfish is in.
I think that they might be able to get to the top. It's just that they're smart enough that, like, it's getting a little warm. I think I'll go back down a little further in the tank. You don't want to be licking at the top there.
It's a little creepy.
All right, I got something closer to home.
Okay, go ahead.
You know the company Wild Edibles? They're a seafood purveyor?
Yes, of course.
They're a great seafood purveyor, and they're very fresh, and they're in the area, and they're based in New York. They've opened up. They had for a long time a takeaway counter. Mm-hmm. They prepare some of their food, simply prepared seafoods, beautiful oysters and lobsters and crab and mollusks of all sorts. Well, they
mollusk.
They
would it
have
be mollusk of all sorts or mollusks?
Mollusks of all sorts.
All right. They have the English lesson.
They have put in. I don't even think you know this. They put in an eat at counter, so you can go into Wild Edibles and
sit at the bar and
eat
and.
That's on 3rd Avenue and 36th Street in Manhattan. 8 deuces, or tables for two, on 3rd Avenue. Really great. Some of the best, freshest fish in Manhattan. Fresh skate, crab cakes. What else do we have there? You have their takeout. They have takeout shops in Grand Central Station, mm-hmm. so people take their food home a lot. They also supply restaurants. They have linguine a la vongole, which is with clams, cockles, little neck clams, oysters, Rockefeller pizza. This is from Gail Green in New York Magazine reporting, and we know we trust her. She's a regular guest on the show. I just love the idea of being. You can go in and you can pick a fish or crustacean from the that they have on ice there, and then they'll roast it for you, $16 to $20.
You know, this is a trend, and I really don't mind this trend, but you're seeing it in lots of places. You're seeing it. I think more poorly done even in the ShopRites and the food towns and places like that, where, you know, you can pick up your rotisserie chicken or whatever that's been sitting under the lights for 10 or 12 hours. But other places, you know, places like Whole Foods, places like Wegmans, places like Wild Edibles have these little table areas now where you can go and pick up some of these prepared foods and either eat them there or bring them home for kind of an easy meal to prepare for your family, almost like like you were doing takeout from a restaurant. And some of these places are doing some pretty good stuff. I have been pleasantly surprised by some of them. I've been unpleasantly surprised by some of the meals as well. But at the, there's some experimentation to be done here, I think.
That speaks to where food culture, I think, is going in America. When people, you know, this is a great debate now. Is New York the center of gravity of cuisine, or is Paris? You know, New York really, a lot of people say...
some people will tell you it's Spain right now.
Well, that is a country as a whole, but as a city, I mean, mm-hmm. people still say New York or Paris. And what people have said, what valid criticism of New York for a long time was, yes, if you go to the best restaurants in New York, they can rival some of the best restaurants in Paris. But if you stop at any street corner in Paris, mm-hmm. you're going to find amazing food. And a lot of what you find in the street corners of New York is schlock. There's some amazing food.
But
where I see this is an example of how this is changing. Momofuku Sambar is a place where it's a very casual place. You can pop in, get something to eat really quickly, and it's phenomenal. And Wild Edibles, again, it's all about the ingredients simply prepared. I can't wait to go.
But how the phenomenon, I think, is different in New York than it is in Paris is that in New York, in Paris, you see a lot of the ingredients, although you see cheeses and salamis and pâtés and things like that that are kind of pre-made. You don't really see somebody with cooked chicken or a store that sells ribs preparing for you an order of spare ribs on the side. You don't see those that kind of thing so much in Paris with the foods that are completely prepared waiting for you to put them in your oven and heat them back up to 240 degrees.
All I have to say is Wild Edibles, you ready for this? This is my favorite. You can go pick oysters, and Wild Edibles is one of the best oyster purveyors mm-hmm. that you will find. Get 6 oysters for just $15 with 3 pours of beer or wine from a local list.
Nice.
Come on, check that out.
Well, that's the other thing that's come from these places. I think that they're expensive for what you would expect to get in a supermarket or a super high-end grocery store or, you know, like Wegmans or things like that. The prepared foods are relatively expensive, but at the same time, they are relatively inexpensive when you compare them to kind of a mid-level restaurant.
But the other thing is you're getting better ingredients than you would normally mm-hmm. find. I mean, Wild Edibles oysters cost $1.50 when the restaurant buys them.
Right.
So you're getting 6 of them for $15 with 3 beers, 3 little beers. I'm in. I'm all in. Let's go. All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk with Fuchsia Dunlop about her book, Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook, which explores recipes from Hunan Province. And you may not know this, but Hunan Province is where General Tso's chicken is from.
Kind of.
And
We'll go into that a little bit later.
General Tso's chicken, very interesting story. And you will not find a more intelligent authority on Chinese cooking than Fuchsia Dunlop. And we're going to ask her a number of questions about real Chinese cooking from China, about what happened between the mainland China and Taiwan, and about how that relates to what you might get at a Chinese restaurant in your town. You might be surprised at just how different it is. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We have with us Fuchsia Dunlop. Fuchsia trained as a chef at China's leading cooking school, the Sichuan Institute of Higher Cuisine in Chengdu, where she lived from 94 to 96. Her first book, Land of Plenty, won the British Guild of Food Writers Award for Best First Book in 2002. She's also a radio journalist for the BBC World Service and writes about Chinese food for the Financial Times, Gourmet, Savoir Magazine, and Time Out. She's a fluent Mandarin speaker, and she joins us today from her home in London.
Fuchsia, great to have you with us on the show today. Welcome.
Hello.
What a lovely book you have written. I mean, both lovely in the words that are contained in it and the pictures as well. Why? You're an Englishwoman, correct?
I am.
And so where is this fascination with Chinese food? You're probably, from what I've read, you're probably the foremost expert in the English speaking world on Chinese cooking. How did you develop this passion?
Goodness me.
Yeah, that's what I read. It's in all the blogs out there.
You might have written it, but we read it.
Well, I mean, the fascination with food started practically from the moment I was born, according to my mother. I've always loved cooking and eating, and I've cooked quite seriously since I was a teenager. And the China thing happened later. I had a journalistic job with part of the BBC where I found myself working a lot on news reports from China. So I started learning Chinese and then went to China first on a holiday and then to learn Mandarin. And when I arrived there, I was so overwhelmed by the deliciousness of the food. I was living in Chengdu, which is one of the great gastronomic capitals of China. And everything I ate there was so delicious and so unlike anything I'd eaten before. And so I just gradually started finding out about it out of greed and curiosity rather than professional interest.
Well, I think if you put greed to good use, it can turn itself around. It's got a bad reputation as a vice, but it can be used to good ends.
You know, I had the great good fortune as a child. One of my closest friends growing up, his parents were from Taiwan. So they had come in, and I got to taste a lot of the foods that we weren't eating in the restaurants in the United States, certainly at that time. You know, you're talking about the 70s. I got to try so many more traditional types of foods that I hadn't. It was outside the expectation of what we as Americans think of as Chinese food.
Is there any relation at all between what Americans or Brits might find in their local Chinese restaurant as a white person going in and ordering off the menu to what actually people in China eat?
I mean, I think a lot of the dishes that you find on Chinese restaurant menus in America and in Britain are Chinese dishes, but they're not really very representative. Often they're things that are not nearly as popular in China as you would think, like sweet and sour pork. I mean, you know, everyone orders it, certainly in London, but it's not terribly common in China itself. And the other thing is that these are just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you have a quite limited repertoire of dishes, and China is so vast and so diverse. And there's just so much more to it than you could possibly imagine from visiting, you know, American Chinese restaurants.
Let's compare that to China to another country, because people do have an idea that they're going to a Chinese restaurant, and that, I find that amusing in a way, is such a broad generalization. I mean, we've had Italian chefs on who say, you know, people say they're going in America to an Italian restaurant, or they'll get specific and say a northern Italian restaurant or a southern Italian restaurant. Where, you know,
see, was that for authenticity, so we would know you weren't in the United States?
Yeah.
That little siren in the background.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are 93 provinces in Italy. How various are, how many different cuisines are there in China?
Well, as many as you want, really. I mean, sometimes people divide it by north and south, the great wheat-eating region in the north, and then the rice-based diet of the south. All people talk about four great regional cuisines, you know, broadly speaking, northern, eastern, and southern, and western. Or you can divide it by province, or even within provinces you have differences. I mean, it really is a vast country. And, I mean, it's like kind of thinking about, you know, European cuisine with all its variations, if you think about China and its variations. And actually, you know, talking about people with this label, Chinese cuisine, for Chinese people, they might say, let's go to a Western restaurant tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how mad is that?
Well, you know, it's sort of funny. It would be, I think that's a great analogy. It would be like saying, let's go to a European restaurant. Could be herring. Could be puttanesca.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when we come back, you've written two books. You've written a book on Chinese, on Hunan cuisine and Sichuan cuisine, which are two neighboring provinces. Is that not correct?
Approximately neighboring, although they don't, I mean, I think now approximately neighboring, but now Chongqing has become a separate municipality, so they're not really adjacent anymore.
Well, let's talk when we come back about two words that Americans are probably very familiar with, Hunan and Sichuan, and what is the differences we might find in the real cuisines therein. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Fuchsia Dunlop about her book, Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:23.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's to Mark and Francis, the restaurant guy. We're talking with Fuchsia Dunlop, one of the foremost experts in the world on Chinese cooking. We were talking before the break. You've written a book on Sichuan cuisine, and now you've written a book on foods from the Hunan province. What would be some of the differences between Sichuan and Hunan cuisine?
They're both very spicy, but one of the major differences is that in Sichuan you get a lot of Sichuan pepper, this spice that makes your lips kind of dance and tingle and makes your mouth rather numb. The Hunanese can't really stand it and hardly use it at all. The Hunanese also don't really like mixing sweet and savory tastes. So whereas in Sichuanese cooking you get a lot of dishes where you've got spicy, savory, sour flavors with a bit of sweetness, in Hunan you get these kind of bold combinations of hot and salty, hot and sour, lots of pickles and so on.
Yet here in the U.S., I think a lot of people think of sweet dishes when they sweet and spicy dishes when they think of Hunan.
Yes, well, they're very, very untypical. And also in Hunan, they use a lot of the black beans, not mashed up into black bean sauce, but just black beans as a seasoning. So very characteristic to have a kind of stir fry with some fresh, bright red chili and some black fermented soybeans. Very typical color.
Well, I think one of the challenges for a Western cook, and one of the things that might and this book is beautiful, by the way, and it's wonderful that you provided us with pictures, because I think it's harder if you haven't grown up with the cuisine to envision what the final dish will look like. What challenges does a home cook, say, in America or the U.K., face when trying to prepare foods like this as far as sourcing ingredients or equipment or sort of understanding the metrics of it?
With ingredients, basically, you have to go to your local Chinese supermarket and get a few sort of staple seasonings, things like soy sauce and vinegar and so on. And fresh ingredients, a lot of them you can just buy in a regular kind of grocery store or supermarket. There are some more obscure vegetables that you'll only get in a good Chinatown. But in terms of equipment, I mean, Chinese cooking can be very, very simple. You know, a wok is a good thing to have, and a cleaver helps with the cutting. But you don't need a huge amount of very special equipment. But I think really that, I mean, just learning another cuisine, it's a bit like learning a language. You know, you need a few basic rules of grammar, and then you can start speaking it. And it's just that in Chinese cooking, the basic processes are a little bit different from those in the West. And once you've got your head around those, it's not really so complicated. I mean, this, after all, is the kind of stuff that people in China cook every night for supper.
Yeah, we've been very fortunate here in the Northeast. A lot of kind of Asian markets and different kind of specialty markets have been opening up in suburbs. In our major Chinatowns.
We have such a large population out here of Asian people.
We're seeing so many of these different kind of specialty stores that have a lot of these specialty ingredients in them that you can experiment with.
And, you know, it's funny. I have had the experience of going into Chinese restaurants with Chinese friends or Chinese American friends, and, you know, the menu is a little different, or it's a lot different, actually, if you're not ordering off the American side of the menu. And I think it's very interesting to look at what is actually going on in China. Who's using your book? Some books, at least in America, a lot of these beautiful cookbooks, and yours is a beautiful cookbook, are destined for the coffee table and never to enter the kitchen. Do you think that home cooks are using your books to actually cook the food or just sort of learn about the concepts?
Well, quite a lot of people on the internet, on various blogs, talk about using them and cooking the recipes and post pictures of dishes that they've made from my books. And also, the thing that delights me most is that actually I've had, there are some kind of reviews on Amazon of the first book, you know, with people actually cooking recipes for their Sichuanese friends.
And how'd that work out?
Yeah, very well. And in fact, one guy on his blog was saying that his mother, who was actually Sichuanese, had started cooking Sichuanese food again from my book, and
nice.
Then got back in touch with her, you know, her heritage.
What goes around comes around. Listen, we're going to take a break for the news. Will you stick with us and come back on the other side?
Sure.
Absolutely. We'll be back after the news with Fuchsia Dunlop. The book is Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook. You can find it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and order it through there. Back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're speaking with Fuchsia Dunlop. She is one of the English-speaking world's top experts on Chinese cooking. Her new book is Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook Recipes from the Hunan Province, and you can pick that up through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. And she's speaking with us today from her home in London.
You know, Fuchsia, I was talking earlier in the show about, you know, I grew up with nearly best friends with a gentleman whose family was from Taiwan. His parents were immigrants from Taiwan. And one of the things that was striking, and though they tried very hard to Americanize this in their cooking, one of the things that was striking was there were a lot of vegetables in the cuisine. You know, we go to Chinese restaurants, I think, today, and so many of the dishes are meat-based. But a lot of the dishes were truly vegetarian or soy-based or something to that effect. Or do you find that a lot in true Chinese cooking?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Most Chinese people eat a diet which is dominated by vegetables, and vegetable cookery, actually, is one of the great delights of real Chinese cooking. You get a huge range of vegetables, very fresh, very healthy food. And I think it's a great misconception in the West that, you know, people go and they see all these deep-fried dishes in heavy, sweet, salty sauces, and they think that's Chinese food. But on the one hand, you know, Chinese people, when they go out to a restaurant, they might eat more kind of meat and fish and so on, because you're going out to a restaurant to splash out and, you know, this sort of thing. But home cooking is very different. And actually, you know, I think people sometimes think that Chinese food is a bit junky, or you wouldn't want to eat it every day. It's not very healthy. But actually, one of the things that impressed me most about living in China was how wonderful and healthy and delicious the kind of daily diet of my friends was.
You know, one of the things I find very interesting in your book, and I think that an evolution of cookbooks has occurred, where they are now at the point where most cookbooks are not just collections of recipes. A cookbook's job is as much to contextualize the recipes it contains as it is to deliver the recipes and the photographs of how to do the food. And your book does that as well. You know, so many cuisines, I mean, cuisine is inextricably tied to history, and some are tied to recent historical events. Like Irish cookery, you can't talk about a history of it without talking about, you know, what happened in the last couple of hundred years and talking about the political situation. And China, with the revolution and the Cultural Revolution, is the same thing. Will you talk to us about some of the historical aspects and how history has affected Chinese cuisine?
Yeah, well, that was one of the main purposes of the book, in a way, because I've been researching Chinese food for a long time, and I was very struck by how all these very turbulent events of China's 20th century have had their impact on the way people ate. So, you know, you started the century with the last imperial dynasty, then you had a republic, you had civil war, Japanese invasion, you know, communist takeover, cultural revolution, and now this kind of capitalist revolution, and it's all been reflected in food. And so I wanted to reflect that, sort of telling stories of recipes that were associated with particular periods, you know, with times of great hardship in the early 60s, with the cultural revolution, with, you know, an imperial official, perhaps. Yeah, so that was one of the points of the book, really. And I think, anyway, that you can just, I mean, China's a society that's particularly obsessed with food, and you can understand so much through, well, in my experience, through researching food and cooking with people about politics, about history, about medicine, anything you like, really.
Well, there are two points you raised there. One that I found most interesting and disturbing in the book, in a society that is so concerned about cooking, that has such a rich culinary history and has cuisine as such a large part of its overall culture. You talk about after the revolution with Mao's Cultural Revolution, basically the restaurants were pretty fine dining restaurants were pretty much closed, and even home cooking was not possible to do for a while. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I mean, in the commune period, people were expected to eat in communal canteens, disgusting food by all accounts. And even in the Great Leap Forward, things like cooking pots were melted down in this crazy attempt to make steel as part of this kind of wild idea of industrialization. So, yeah, it did. I mean, you know, Chinese gastronomy is just one of the many, many tragedies of the Cultural Revolution and so on. And it's taken a long time to recover.
Well, and also you point to, during this time where traditional cuisine was under attack on the mainland, Taiwan became sort of a guardian or a repository of a lot of those mainland traditions. Did it function that way? And have those traditions migrated back from Taiwan to mainland China?
Is there kind of a counter food revolution going on now?
Well, it is incredibly interesting because actually at the end of the Chinese Civil War, sort of 1949-1950, you had the nationalist elite, the defeated nationalists, fleeing to the island of Taiwan, and they took with them their kind of retinues, who included some very famous chefs, one of whom I met when I went to Taiwan. So you got these people who were used to cooking for these very very refined and discerning sort of scholar official types. And they went on cooking the recipes of their homeland, which they missed terribly, you know, in the early days in Taiwan. And I think for a long time, this kind of Chinese haute cuisine was preserved in Taiwan, on Taiwan, better than it was in the mainland. Now what you find is in Taiwan, the regional cuisines have got kind of mixed up together because it's a small island and there's been lots of mixing of staff among different traditions. And, of course, the old generation of chefs from particular provinces have mostly, you know, died out, literally. So you've got kind of younger chefs born on Taiwan. And then in the mainland, you've now got this terrific resurgence of restaurant culture, which is very, very impressive. So, although, I mean, some curiosities, like there's one Taiwan restaurant chain called Din Tai Fung, which specializes in this delicious steamed soup dumpling, Xiaolongbao. And they've now actually opened branches in Shanghai, which is where the dumpling originally came from. And they claim that they do it much better than the Taiwanese places. Than the old Shanghainese places, which I rather agree with.
That's funny how what does go around comes around. Let me ask you, because I'm fascinated not only with cooking but with the rites and rituals of dinner. That's actually the title of a book by a woman named Margaret Visser. It's an excellent, excellent book. But does the meal have the same sort of place in the day in a Chinese household or in Chinese restaurants than it does in Western culture? I mean, can it be a long, drawn-out affair of, you know, sitting down over a lot of food? Or is it mostly quicker and simpler than that?
Well, in general in China, I would say that the food is incredibly important and the meal is like the heart of family life in many ways. But people tend to eat much more quickly with less conversation and then go and do something else afterwards. So you can, well, now, for example, you might go out to a restaurant with Chinese friends and you will eat early and fast. And then you'll go on to, you know, a karaoke bar or a tea house or something afterwards.
Interesting.
And I think that, you know, comparing with European cuisines where we have, you know, at the more high level, this fantastically complicated system of table manners, different knives and forks and spoons and things like that. In China, you just got your chopsticks and, you know, your rice bowl, basically. And it tends to be much, much simpler,
and
more straightforward. Yeah.
Well, we'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Fuchsia Dunlop. Her book is Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook Recipes from the Hunan Province, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:43.
Let me talk to you about lighting and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps, to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightsonnine.com. That's lightsonthenumber9.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We're speaking with Fuchsia Dunlop from her home in London, where she's talking about Chinese cuisine. She's one of the world's foremost experts on Chinese cuisine. In your new book, Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook, you have the story of, and also I read a recent article that you wrote, on the story of a very important dish that foreigners know maybe more than Hunanese, General Tso's chicken. Who was General Tso, and why are we eating his chicken?
And why are we eating so much of it?
Yeah.
And did General Tso really have all that cornstarch?
Yeah, I mean, that was a really amazing story, because before I went to Hunan to research this book, I didn't really know a lot about Hunanese food, but the one thing I'd heard about it was this famous dish, and also chicken, which, as you know, is on every, certainly, East Coast American restaurant menu. So when I went to Hunan, I was a little surprised to find that no one had heard of it. You know, it was not on any restaurant menus. There was no dish like it with which I was served. And generally, yeah, nobody knew about this, although General Tso is a very famous military figure of the Chinese past, and Hunanese are very proud of him. So I was puzzled by this, and it was only when I went to Taiwan, actually, and met with this older generation chef who was a Hunanese exile, that I discovered the story, because, in fact, this man, Peng Changwei...
He's the expatriate chef, Peng Changwei.
Yeah, a famous chef from Hunan who was cooking for the Taiwan for the nationalist government banquets in the 1950s. And he invented lots of new dishes. And one of the dishes he invented was this General Tso's chicken, which was sort of loosely based on his Hunanese heritage, you know, with its hot and sour taste. But he used larger pieces of chicken than normal, for one thing. Anyway, he went and opened a restaurant called Peng's in New York, in Manhattan. And then he discovered that Americans liked eating rather sweet food. And so he started adding sugar to the recipe. And this is the recipe which sort of stuck in America. Anyway, later he went back to Taiwan, and everyone seems to have kind of forgotten where it came from. But yes, this is a dish that kind of was born out of, you know, Hunan via Taiwan, modified for American taste.
And so
it happens to be named after this historical figure with whom it doesn't actually have any historical connection.
So the General Tso's chicken, as we know, it was pretty much invented in New York. But now you write in your book, I was fascinated to read, that Hunanese chefs who travel around the world feel obligated to be able to cook it.
Well, yes, I mean, that was a funny thing, because, you know, when I went to Hunan, I said, you know, no one eats this dish. But I did meet a few chefs who had traveled abroad, one of whom, you know, did a kind of DVD of classic Hunanese dishes, and one of the dishes was General Tso's chicken. And there's also a couple of quite well-known books about Hunanese cooking, which include the recipe, and they say, oh, yeah, this was a dish which General Tso liked to eat. But, you know, if you look a bit deeper, there's no evidence for
now,
this sort of
also, thing. General Tso was long dead before the 70s, right? What period did he live in?
Early 19th century. Yeah, a long time ago.
Well, I wanted to bring us to the topic of rice. I thought it was very interesting in your book. You discussed two different ways of cooking rice that are a traditional Hunanese way and a more modern Hunanese way of cooking rice. Will you talk to us about that?
You can boil the rice and then steam it. Or the kind of favorite traditional way is to, first of all, kind of parboil your rice in water, and then cook it very, very gently in the embers of the fire. Hunanese kitchens tend to have wood fires, wood-fired stoves, and even fires on the kitchen floor. And you cook it very slowly, so the rice kind of absorbs the water, and it develops this lovely golden crust on the bottom called the guo ba. So it's a kind of rustic way of cooking rice, but it's come back into fashion with the vogue for rustic restaurants.
So that's sort of like the cookie on the bottom of the fondue pot, right? The crusty part on the bottom.
Yeah.
And that's not something to be avoided. That's a delicacy, right?
It's delicious, yes. Yeah.
In Italian food, it would be the crusty top of the baked ziti. Same kind of principle. That my mom would always, you know, not let me eat because she ate it herself.
Well, yeah. In Irish food, there's no equivalent. So now, the other thing that I wanted to talk about that I was really fascinated when reading through your book is I've been reading a lot about how in older American kitchens, in the 19th century American kitchens, there was a lot of use in putting, because we put up a lot of produce. We put up a lot of local produce to use in our restaurants throughout the year. But there was a lot of, and there are a lot of different ways to put things up, whether by boiling or using alcohol, but there was a lot of use in the 19th century in America of fermenting vegetables and fermenting different things and putting them up in jars. And I saw that a lot in your book as well. What role does fermenting play in Hunan cuisine, and how does that work with the flavors, and how important is it to Hunan cuisine?
Very important. I mean, you get things like fermented bean curd, which has a really strong cheesy taste. And that's something that most rural households still make, and then you can eat it just as an appetizer on its own, or you can use it as a cooking ingredient. And then you have things like soy sauces and fermented black soybeans, which have these kind of wonderful, rich, savory, what we would call umami tastes, that you might also get from things like, you know, good hams and meaty things. But for poor people who are mostly eating kind of rice and vegetables, to have these delicious, you know, fermented soy products, it really added something to the diet. And then apart from that, there are lots of pickles, sort of pickled vegetables, dried vegetables, pickled chilies, particularly salt chilies kind of chopped up and packed with salt into a jar, bola jar, chopped salted chilies, which are one of the most characteristic seasonings of Hunan.
Now, I think in the United States here, we underappreciate soy sauce because we kind of there's really basically one brand that most of the country eats, and it's kind of this ubiquitous, not as interesting soy sauce as they're available in other parts of the world.
So the fermented soy products, are these commercially available, do you think, or are they mostly made in people's homes?
No, I mean commercially available definitely as well, now.
Well, let's take this to, I'm dying to find out your methodology of how you collected, you know, an English woman in China, how you went about collecting all of these authentic recipes from throughout. Where did you get them? Who did you ask?
Well, it's like a great mixture of things, really. I mean, a lot of time I just spend in restaurant kitchens and in kitchens of friends, you know, watching people cook, and I've sort of developed a system of writing down recipes as I go along and describing them and then recreating them when I get home. Some of them, you know, there are several different versions from different people. Some of them I might have been from watching people cook in the kitchen, and one of them might just have been told to me by someone. But I have enough experience now that I can sort of cook from someone's description often. Yes.
I think that's absolutely fascinating.
So I have to tell you, Fuchsia, that the expression, and this has been a great, great interview, but the expression splash out is about to become part of my vernacular. That's, I'll be using that one again, and I'm telling you now, I probably won't be quoting you.
If you would like to pick up Fuchsia Dunlop's book, and if you're at all interested in Chinese cuisine, I suggest that she has several books on Chinese cuisine. Sichuan and Hunan, the current book we're talking about, is Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook Recipes from the Hunan Province, and you can actually cook this stuff at home, especially if you live around here. We know you can find all these ingredients. Fuchsia, thank you for coming on our
Thanks
show.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys.
You know, what we were talking about in the show earlier about, you know, Chinese food and of course, about the great tradition of Chinese food. And of course, I talked about my friend John Su, who's a very good friend of mine growing up. And, you know, the cuisines that his parents would bring. And his parents would make traditional egg rolls, and they'd make lots of traditional foods. And growing up, if you went to John's house and had lunch at his house, you had traditional Chinese food, and it was very interesting and very delicious. And to this day, my friends have not let me live down. Maybe I'm 10 years old, 11 years old, and I talked to Mrs. Su. I said, Mrs. Su, you know what would really make these egg rolls even better? They're the best egg rolls I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
But you know what would make these really great?
What?
More meat. These egg rolls, if they just had a little more meat, they'd be perfect. And you know what I'm going to tell you?
Maybe some red sauce.
Can I tell you something?
What?
She put more pork into the egg rolls.
Uh-huh.
They were spectacular. They didn't put a lot of pork. If they put any pork at all, it was a small amount because they didn't have that much pork to put into their egg rolls. And it literally, my friends to this day are like, oh yeah, it all started with Mrs. Su's egg rolls.
That was your first culinary adventure.
Your whole critiquing of other people's food began.
I will tell you that I don't want to make this a show about past friends, but mm-hmm. Through Johnny Su, I met him sophomore year of college, mm-hmm. and I remember he brought something from home. His mother made a chicken dish. Mm-hmm. I still have the recipe.
Yeah.
And, you know, here I am, a 19-year-old college student, and John said, yeah, I got some. You want some? I was like, yeah, sure. And I was like, this is so awesome. In the dorm room at Rutgers.
Yep.
And I remember sophomore year, because that's when I met you, and that's mm-hmm. when I met him. I insisted that his mother give me, he get the recipe from me, and he did it. He thought I was weird as hell. But I've cooked that chicken recipe, and I think of Johnny Sue every time I do it.
I think it's, you know, you wonder sometimes if you were predisposed to fall into a certain field.
I don't wonder.
And I look at my past of, you know, culinary past as a child, you know, being fascinated by a Michelin 2-star restaurant as a 10-year-old. And you realize that maybe this was where the direction we were supposed to go.
I never wondered for a moment. In fact, I'm a little hungry right now, so it's almost the noon hour. Why don't we have some lunch while we listen to the news?
So, Mrs. Sue, thanks very much for putting the extra pork in the egg rolls. They were spectacular.
I hope you've enjoyed this ridiculous hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Chong.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.